Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sandra Cisneros, whose latest book is Have You Seen Marie?, which is illustrated by Esther Hernandez. Sandra Cisneros has written two novels, Caramelo and The House on Mango Street, books of poetry, essays, one collection of short stories thus far. This is your first book in 10 years, and I want to start by asking, before we get into the book itself and the nature of grief, which is what the book is about, I want to ask, it took 10 years and you're coming out with this. What's been happening in the past 10 years since Caramelo?
I have been working on essays and poetry and creating two foundations and, you know, just living my life and also traveling and promoting the books in other languages. So I've been traveling and creating a children's book that's going to be published in Italy. So other projects have taken precedence. This story actually is a couple of years old because usually when you finish a book, you know, it takes a year for the production. But in this case, I had to wait also for Esther Hernandez to do the drawings. So I finished the story maybe 2 years ago. And it was also a story that changed shape because I would read it out loud. And I'm very much a writer whose work is based in the spoken word. I would read it out loud, and it would change as I performed it in different cities and different places.
So it was almost a theater piece that we're now seeing in print.
All my work is performance pieces, and I think the work of many writers of color, writers who have indigenous roots as its basis, the spoken word, I think that my writing, even my first book, House on Mango Street, is based very much on spoken story, perhaps even more so spoken story in another language transcribed into English, which is what gives House on Mango Street its peculiar lilt.
I do want to talk about the relationship of Spanish and English, because when I look at well-translated Spanish, so we're talking about anything from Gabriel Garcia Marquez to Garcia Lorca, there's a certain poetry there that is unique. It may also be that Spanish is a more poetic language than in English, too.
It is a very poetic language, and I think in particular the Spanish of Mexico has a wonderful animistic attitude that perhaps you might not see in the Spanish of the peninsula. And I think that has to do with the indigenous way of looking at nature.
Sandra Cisneros, have you seen Marie? Stems from dealing with issues involving the death of your mother. And as you've said in an interview, middle-aged orphans don't seem to get much press anywhere. It's like they don't exist.
I think that one of the great primordial fears we have once we become conscious of our aloneness as children is the fear of losing our mother. You know, we have that from the moment that we realize we can lose her just in the supermarket, and it's traumatic, and it's one of the things I remember not wanting to think about when I was a child. It was more terrifying than arithmetic. I didn't want to think about the loss of my mother or my father. And when I lost my father, I thought I learned about grief and about transition. However, nobody tells you what it's like once you lose your mother, which is very profound and it's very deep. And they don't tell you that you're going to feel like an orphan at whatever age you are as an adult. You know, we tend to think of orphans as being, you know, protagonist of stories we read when we're kids. And yet here you are. You know, you're an adult. You're supposed to manage. You're supposed to get over it. You're supposed to go on with your life. And you feel like a lost child.
And it doesn't matter what your religion is.
Yeah, either. It doesn't matter what your religion or what your spirituality or what your ethnicity or how old you are, you still feel like a lost child.
When did your mother pass, and how did this book, which on the surface is about searching for a cat, but it's something else,
yes.
How did that emerge?
Well, see, in real life, my mother passed away in 2007 on November 1st. On one of the days of the dead, because you know there are 2 days of the dead, November 1st and November 2nd, that are celebrated in Mexico. And my mother passed away on the day of the lost souls of children. Seems very appropriate because she had so many children. And in March, I had a visiting writer come to town in relation to my Writers Foundation. And she lost her cat, and she didn't know anyone in town except me. I felt obligated to help her look for the cat. And this was just a few months after my mother's death, when I was feeling absolutely terrified of running into anybody, whether I knew them or not. Because when you're in that state of grief, at any moment, any little breeze, any hello, any confrontation, any grazing of someone meeting your eyes might cause you suddenly to burst into grief. You might just start crying. You could be looking at a jar of peanut butter in the supermarket, and then you'll start crying and you think about your mom or something. So it's horrible to be in that state where you can't control yourself. You feel frightened all the time. You want to stay home. And I was in that agoraphobic phase. I found myself, because I was the host of this residency, going out maybe 2 weeks looking for this animal with her, and it caused a lot of discomfort. I didn't like the idea that I was out of the house, and I also didn't like that I was wasting my time. I thought I was wasting time walking around, crawling underneath cars. You know, it's just a waste of time. I was thinking I should be in my office. So I was annoyed. I remember being really mad and thinking, oh, brother, you know, this is just such a bother. But I think what happened and what the experience taught me is I needed to be present in the real Buddhist sense of paying attention, and paying attention at that to the present moment instead of thinking I should be back in my office writing. And once I woke up to listening to what was going on around me, watching what was going on around me, looking at a little girl who had picked up the flyer, and, you know, just being astonished by how people reacted, I started thinking in my head, oh, I think there's a story here. Wake up. Stop thinking about your office. Start paying attention to what people are telling you. Look around. Look at the trees and the flowers. And the more I did that, the more I felt connected to my mom. You know, as much as I was in grief, it was wonderful to be walking under trees and looking at the crackles and walking along the river. And I felt very nourished, the way like when you're thirsty, when you drink a glass of water. I felt nourished and calm and happy for the first time. And that's when I took the idea to my desk. Meanwhile, my friend was still searching for her cat. I went back to my desk, started taking notes. Eventually, she found her cat. And I started weaving the story, not only of the search for the cat, but of my neighbors who have had death visit their house. Every single house has had death visit them. And I knew that from living there for 20 years. So that's the story I wrote.
What had you been working on at that point? I mean,
yes.
There had been several months,
yes,
after your mother died, and you were still in grief. What was that?
I created an altar, and I see that you have one here in the studio. It's very wonderful if you can create an altar. Even if you're an agnostic or an atheist, you can create an altar. Because an altar is simply an homage, paying homage to someone's life and celebrating what they did. And when you start collecting items intuitively instead of using words, just going around the house or going to shops and thrift stores and saying, this reminds me of so-and-so. Oh, I know this person would have loved this. He liked to drink this. And you collect those things and put them together. It creates a way of grieving, but also laughing and feeling happy and feeling their presence. Because once you can get over the grief and open yourself to the joy, you really feel as if you've transformed your sadness into illumination, which is really all that art is. All we want to do is transform the negative emotions into light. We want to compost them into light.
So at that point, you were doing the homage, but you weren't getting to being in the present day, which is what this
is. I wrote this story. I created an altar that's currently up at the Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque, and I hope somebody in the Bay Area will take the altar on after it comes down this year. And then I also wrote an essay that appeared in Granta. So I was working on nonfiction, fiction, and a installation piece. And all these things helped me to understand my mother in a way that I didn't understand her when she was alive. Because, you know, daughters have very difficult relationships with their mothers, the way I'm sure men have with their fathers. And I think when she was alive, it was always like, you don't understand me, or you can't see me. But I think when she died, I got to understand her and to see the places that I couldn't see when I was just self-centered and thinking about my own needs. It was good to have a meditation, a long meditation, because it took many months to write the story, many months to tweak it, and a long year of collecting all the items I was putting on her altar. The altar didn't go up immediately. It took a while. And a long time to process and think about my mother's life and what she gave me and how she was present in my life now instead of what she missed or how she wasn't there for me. I started seeing the things that she was.
Sandra Cisneros, you spent time revamping, getting in front of audiences, telling this story over and over, refining it. At what point did you realize, you know, if I can find a great illustrator, this can become a book?
Well, let me tell you, Richard, when you speak words that are relevant to people, they automatically shut up, and you know you are in the presence of some very magical words, right? That's a gift when someone can listen to you and be quiet and not interrupt. And when I was reading this story on the 25th anniversary tour of House on Mongo Street, I could tell that it was medicine for certain people in the audience. There would be this silence. Their eyes would well up with tears. They were just listening, and I thought, oh my God, I've just opened this genie bottle and let out some powerful force here. So I knew it wasn't going to be a short story in my next collection. I said, this needs to be its own little book. It needs to be a book, perhaps with some drawings. And I knew it was having a medicinal effect on listeners. And that's when I asked Esther, because I had shared the story with her. Her mom had died, and she was brokenhearted about the death of her mom. And I knew she would understand. So I tried to convince her, even though she's not a book illustrator, she's a famous painter, about joining me on this collaboration of creating a powerful little book that's not quite an adult book, not quite a children's book. It's not quite a fairy tale. It's kind of hard to classify it, a story that's for all ages and something that would be medicine if you had your heart broken. And she went on this journey with me. It was a difficult journey. I think people who are artists can tell how much work she put into it. And we wanted a little book that would fit in your hands, that you could put in your bicycle bag or your purse, that you could give to somebody who is in a state of immense sadness.
Esther came to San Antonio and apparently took hundreds of pictures.
Yes, she did. She even climbed in the river with me. I made her wade through the river. I said, oh, Esther, you've got to get in the river. If you're going to write about the river, you've got to. Come on, you know, roll up your pants and leave your shoes. And climbed in with me and my dogs and waded through the water and walked all over the neighborhood in the heat. And we talked to people. Sometimes we met people and we would just go up to strangers and say, oh, we like you. Can we photograph you? And sometimes we'd knock on the door of a particular person who's included in the story and ask them to pose. But we had a lot of fun. It was a way for us to grieve. We even sat under the magical tree that's in the book and sat there and meditated for our moms, because our moms were extraordinary women who didn't have the opportunities that we had. I know that Esther comes from a migrant family. My mom never finished the ninth grade. She became politically conscious thanks to Studs Terkel and the radio. She started reading all the books we brought home from college and was a great fan of Noam Chomsky. She would be very proud that I'm here at this radio station. She's a real lefty. And, you know, yet she was not able to meet her dream of becoming an artist. She wasn't able to be the person she wanted to be. She got drafted into motherhood, big time, seven kids. And that wasn't the life that she had planned. So she opened the path so that I could be the artist she wanted to be, you see. And I just felt, you know, my mom was a frustrated woman, like so many unhappy women we know who didn't get the opportunities that they wanted. And now I'm on this book tour, and I'm installing the altar at two museums already in the past, and my mom is being celebrated, and I feel her spirit is with me. She's loving it. She's really having a hell of a time.
You're listening to an interview with Sandra Cisneros, whose book is titled Have You Seen Marie? One other element to Have You Seen Marie is that it's kind of a love story about San Antonio, particularly the images. I mean, it gives me a view of San Antonio in a way that I never had before. I've never been there.
You see, that's the problem. People come to San Antonio and they go downtown to the Riverwalk and they think that's San Antonio, and they really need to walk downriver towards the Mission, the South Side, or go west, or go east to the communities that are not as prosperous and really take a look, you know. And I wanted to break the stereotype of my neighborhood, which is a historic neighborhood. People think that I live, you know, with big mansions and big, beautiful palace-like houses. But, you know, there are modest homes of all economic levels and all kinds of people in my neighborhood. You know, there's kinds of stories that the Alamo forgets to remember. I wanted to show those stories in the text without clobbering you over the head. I didn't want to say that the couple was a gay couple or two women. I wanted to say a nice couple. And I left it up to Esther to portray what I had in mind. I had thought it would be two men. And she said, oh, no, please make it two women. I said, as you like. And so we asked some neighbors if they would pose, and we just tried to break all the stereotypes of what people think San Antonio looks like, because we have people of all colors, all sexualities, all kinds of folks in the neighborhood. And I wanted to celebrate the beauty of San Antonio's imperfections, the kind of wabi-sabi deal, you know.
Well, for many of us living in California, when we think of Texas, we're thinking George W. Bush, but And right-wing politics.
Well, there's that, too. But, you know, San Antonio is a staunchly Democratic town. It's a little oasis there. And it's also a town where people have lived for 13 generations. And you can meet people who look Latino, but they have a German last name. Or you can meet people that look German, but they have a Spanish first name. So there's that intermarriage that isn't spoken about, those crossing of communities coming together peacefully that often is forgotten about.
Well, what brought you to San Antonio? I mean, you grew up in Chicago.
I did. I was running away from home, Richard.
Really?
I was. I'd lived my whole life in Chicago, and ever since childhood, I wanted to get away and travel. And when I was 28, I was very lucky. I won an NEA grant, the first NEA grant that I would win. And it was the first big-time grant that I got. And the first thing I did was I told everyone, I'm moving to San Francisco.
That's what I did. But
yeah, that's what, well, of course, that's what any writer in their sane mind would say. And I remember someone talking me out of it and saying, oh, you can go to San Francisco anytime. You need to travel. And I thought, yeah, I need to travel. Writers, and, you know, they go all over the place. So my dream was to go to Patagonia and go all the way south, like Che, I suppose. But then I thought about it. You know, I'd never been to Indiana alone, let alone to Patagonia. And I got scared. And I thought, oh, no, I can't go down there. I'm afraid of everything. So I thought, I'll go somewhere where they're used to seeing women traveling alone. So I very reluctantly and sadly bought a one-way ticket to Europe, starting in Greece, which is where I finished House on Mungo Street. And that's how I traveled. Then I came back after a year and a half with no money in my pocket after living in Bosnia. I'd lived in Sarajevo before the war. I lived in the south of France. I learned a lot during that trip and came back with this desire always to travel globally. But unfortunately, I didn't have any money. I was back in square one in Chicago. I took the first job that would take me out of Chicago, and that was a job offer in San Antonio.
What was the job?
The job was director of a literature program at a cultural arts center in the community, and it seemed perfectly made for me. I didn't know anything about San Antonio or Texas. I just knew it was a state that we used to drive through on our way to Mexico that took 2 days to get through, and it was big.
The fact that you had been to Iowa and the fact that you were bilingual would have been keys, I would
think. No, actually, it was disastrous because it was a community art center, and, of course, they had their favorites. The community was vying for this person, person X over person Y, and they hired me, I think, so that they could look good, like, you know, hey, we hired a woman, we hired someone from out of town so that we won't have to deal with this divisive community fighting. But what happened then is that both the X and Y advocates started fighting against me. So it was really a disastrous first year baptism. You know, Texans don't mess with Texas. They're fighters. And now I understand now why there were so few jobs in the arts. It would be like if someone here from the Mission District wanted a job that was highly coveted and someone else in the Mission District wanted that job, and then they go and hire someone from Santa Barbara. Well, imagine the uproar. It was like that. So I understand it now, although at the time I did not. And I quit the job after a year, but it was a detour that turned out to be my destiny. I would win grants that would keep me in Texas. And eventually, I think there's a rule that once you want to live somewhere, and you can't find a job. You know, once I decided I wanted to live in Texas, I couldn't find a job to save my life. I wound up living maybe about a decade, or it felt like a decade, where I was a migrant professor. And I taught at Cal State Chico. I taught here at UC Berkeley. I taught at Irvine and, you know, many different places. And what I would do with the money that I earned is I would take it back to Texas where it was cheaper to live. I could rent an apartment for $200 a month, and I could not do that here. So that's how I was able to buy time to continue writing during the summer or during a semester.
The house on Mango Street, which you worked on when you were in Europe and you came back,
mm-hmm.
It is not your standard novel. I mean,
no.
Work you've done, this, Have You Seen Marie, certainly Caramello, sits outside
the
of...
cross borders. Yeah.
Yeah.
I try to cross borders and do experimental things. And when I wrote House on Mango Street, I began it in Iowa, but I didn't write it for my thesis. I was in the poetry workshop, so I didn't get any credit for the vignettes I was writing on the side. I would write them to keep my spirit alive. So I kind of dog paddled through a depressing period being there by writing the fiction for myself. And I actually submitted poetry for my thesis.
Sandra Cisneros, eventually in 1984, House on Mango Street was published by a small Houston press.
That's right. It actually was an Indiana press originally that had moved to Houston, and they were the ones that alerted me to the job in San Antonio. That's why I went down south. My idea was to live in Texas for a year and then move to San Francisco.
So you sent the manuscript off to this small press at that point?
Yes.
How did you come across them?
Well, they were publishers of a small magazine, Revista Chicano Riqueña, that used to come out of Indiana. And I knew about them because they published my work. So they asked me if I had more, and I said yes, but most of them are here. And I tapped my head, and they said, well, would you like to do a book? And it was like that. So basically the book was asked for before I finished it.
Well, Sandra Cisneros, it took 7 years before, what was it, Random House, I think, finally did it. And when they published it, they also gave you a contract for the short story collection.
They did, yes. My idea was always to start with a small press and then move up to a national press. And, you know, I had those kind of goals for my career all along from the time I was a very young woman. You know, first I want to win a local award, then I want a state, a national award, small press, big press. You know, the way that some women would fantasize about their wedding or their husbands and children, I fantasized about what I wanted to accomplish with my books. And I had a schedule. You know how women have these clock when they're going to have a baby?
Right.
I had a clock of, like, you've got to have the national award by the time you're 30. You need the big press by the time you're 35. By the time you're 40, you've got to have such and such. It was like that. I was always working with these self-driven goals.
Well, it turns out that when Random House decided to publish you, that was around the same time that suddenly they became aware that there were all of these Hispanic writers. That's around the time that Oscar Hijuelos got published for the first time, Julia Alvarez.
Lots of these writers, however, we were all publishing each other. Gary Soto and Lorna Di Cervantes published my first book of poetry out of their own pocket and out of their own labor because nobody else would. When no one was publishing me, Dr. Norma Alarcón, professor at Berkeley, she's the one that started publishing and created Third Woman Press to fill in the gap where no one else was picking us up. So you have to think about the little magazines, the efforts of many, many writers who were publishing and writing in the 60s and the 70s. Before Gary Soto and Anna and me came along, there were other writers out there, and there are still many writers here in the Bay that have not been discovered by the East Coast. I'm coming up and meeting extraordinary writers, Gino Valdez, who I just saw in Portland, novelist and a poet, Of course, now we have young people like Eduardo Corral, won the Yale Younger Poets Award. And it's wonderful to see that because there are so many good poets coming up. Jose Antonio Rodriguez, published by Luis Rodriguez. So many of the writers ourselves, we have to put our money forward to give grants or to publish the books because we're still, you know, there's only a few of us that are paid attention to in New York, and there's legions behind us that are not.
And even though it's better and people like Juno Diaz from the Dominican but New Yorker can get published, still a lot of Latino and Latina writers are having similar problems because they're minorities.
You know, Denise Chavez has finished her novel and she hasn't sold it yet. You know, she's having a hard time. So there's a lot of writers that have been there and are older and still having hard times even now. So I sometimes wonder, should we pool our resources and do our own press here. There are lots of presses here on the West Coast. I don't know. I just feel that the East and the West are two different worlds, and I sometimes get saddened when I see that very few writers of color are reviewed in East Coast presses and magazines or published. So sometimes we have to pick up the slack ourselves and create those foundations that give those awards, or sometimes we have to do what Luis Rodriguez, who's not a wealthy man, you know, he publishes the writers himself with the Achucha Press. He's doing phenomenal work all by himself and with volunteers and his wife.
Do you think the existence of the Internet helps get writers out there? Because it's also countered by the loss of bookstores.
It's countered by the loss of getting paid for your work, too. You know, if you put your work out in a literary magazine that doesn't protect your rights and puts it out on the Internet, then you may not be able to sell your book. So, you know, we have that problem of especially genres like poetry. We have great poets like Martín Espada, Luis Rodriguez, and, you know, these writers are going out there, and a lot of times when they publish their works in magazines, people can pick them up and reprint them and not buy the books themselves. So I worry about our writers as they're getting older. You know, some of them are getting into medical difficulties, or they're so generous, but they don't take care of themselves. So I worry about them.
Well, you're also in a unique position because you do have these two best-selling books.
I do, and I have a kind of crossover audience that goes from third grade all the way to adults, and that keeps my book on the shelf.
After writing House on Mongo Street and then the short story collection, you began working on Caramello. It took you, I think, 9 years to write.
9 years to write it, a whole year to edit it. Yeah, not to edit, to proofread it. It was a decade of my life, and, you know, I wanted to do it so that I could show everyone, yes, I can write a big, fat book, because sometimes House on Mongo Street gets dismissed as, oh, that little book, you know, and I wanted to show people I could handle a big novel. It did win some international prizes. It didn't get the attention that I think it merited here in the United States yet, but I think it will. And, you know, I'm happy that it won the Dublin Impact, that it made the short list, that it won an international prize in Italy. And I feel that it's yet to do its work the way that House on Mongo Street, it took a long time for House, too, to do its healing work. And I think Caramello, which is dedicated to the immigrants, will do its work, perhaps not in my lifetime, but eventually.
The turning point, I understand, in your writing was when you finally said, you know, this is me. I can't do a linear novel. Screw that. I'm just going to write what I need to write.
Well, as I said, when I was in graduate school, I wasn't in the fiction workshop. I wrote poetry. And that's lucky now in hindsight because my friends were on the fiction workshop. My very good friend Dennis Mathis was in the fiction workshop, and he's worked closely in nurturing my non-traditional style of storytelling, which is cyclical and more female in structure. And he's always encouraged me to be idiosyncratic, that there's something kind of quirky about the way that I say things, and he'll encourage that. He never tries to force me to sound different or to write in a different way. So he's been my fiction mentor through all these years and is one of my closest friends.
Once that happened, once he gave you this advice and you began working, did the process suddenly get a little bit easier?
No, each book gets harder. Each book gets harder and harder, and I just always feel like crying when I have to write. People think I like writing, but I tell people, no, I don't enjoy writing. I like having written.
Is that why you felt guilty when you were out there looking for the damn cat? Because you're going, I need to write.
Well, I always feel guilty like I'm not working as much. I think because Caramelo would take 8-hour, 12-hour days, and I thought I had to be working that hard again. I wasn't kind to myself and saying, hey, your mother just died. Why don't you grieve? You know, we're always hardest on ourselves. So I felt like I had to be working and producing pages. And, you know, it's a good thing that I was out there, good lucky, as my mother would say, that I was out there talking to people about the cat, because if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't have discovered how wonderful it was to be out in nature, with the animals, with things of the spirit that helped to elicit the story of my mother, which helped me to reconnect with my mother's spirit.
Well, Sandra Cisneros, you're planning to leave San Antonio. You know where you're going?
I do not know where I'm going. I'm going to be kind of just exploring and opening my heart to a town that is smaller than San Antonio, but a town that is bigger in the way that towns can be international sometimes. I need an international small city or a large big town. I don't know which. I don't close myself to the possibility of someplace outside the United States, but it would have to be someplace with an indigenous community because that's where I feel at home.
What makes you decide it's just time to leave San Antonio?
No, I've always decided everything with my heart. I knew it was time to get out of Chicago with my heart. And moving to that job 26 years ago in San Antonio felt right at the moment. And it also feels right in my heart right now that I have to close up the work I've been doing, taking care of others, doing philanthropy work, a lot of foundation work. I need to move away from that and focus more on my own writing.
So you're planning to move back into possibly writing more large novels, or don't you know yet?
I don't think I'll write a large novel again because it was kind of like being in jail for me. You know, I felt very unhappy during the 10 years. Even though that's the funniest book I've ever written, it was the saddest period of my life.
Well, there was also a lot of anger built up over house painting.
Yeah, but that came in the middle of trying to write my novel. That's the last thing I needed was someone to deal with what is authentic colors of San Antonio. I didn't need to open up a historical can of worms. I think I need to live somewhere that is nurtures my presence and that understands and appreciates its indigenous heritage.
When the issues happened in San Antonio over painting bright colors,
it really was a bigger issue, Richard. It was about historical exclusion, because what was happening is we were being asked to paint our homes historical colors as deemed by a Western palette, a European palette. That would be all right. But if my home in a historic district was painted a color that was a color of Mexico, then that was a problem. And, you know, it was all right when we talked about preserving Spanish architecture, but I didn't see any Mexican or Mexican-American architecture being preserved. We could see our colors and our culture exploited on the Riverwalk when it was deemed beautiful by an architect, but if we put those colors ourselves in a historic home, then all hell was raised. So I didn't mean to create this uproar. I just painted my house what I thought was a beautiful color for the Southwest, colors I'd seen in Mexico. But it raised the issue about historical exclusion of the Mexican and Mexican-American aesthetics.
And so it came down to racism.
You want to say it that way? Okay.
Well, what's odd is that would have been in, I guess, the mid to late 90s.
It happened in 97, but what happened as a result of that, and even though it took a lot of my energy and time to investigate it when I didn't have time, is that as a result, the panel on the historic review board is much more colorful than it was then. And we're also seeing homes in the neighboring historic neighborhood of Lavaca. They wrote up their charter so that any color could be used on their houses.
Well, I think that also has to do with the change in consciousness in terms of architecture, in terms of the United States as well. You're seeing more preservation, more people hearkening back to brighter colors. I mean,
but see, the thing that's curious, Richard, is that even the Alamo, even the doors of the Alamo had paint. And however, when things get renovated, they get literally whitewashed so that becomes the color for all time. I wasn't trying to make trouble. I was just painting my house a color that I thought was alegre, you know, filled with life and beauty. And little did I realize in a town named San Antonio that I was going to have to translate those colors. You know, we had to wake up the historic review board that the natives also have history, and that history is valid too.
And that's what's happening now.
Yes.
It seems that one of the directions you're going in, as you talk about Have You Seen Marie, is
Performing.
Yeah,
well, I think all my work has been anchored in performance from the days of poetry. I think poetry is meant to be read out loud. And for our community, a lot of times people can't buy your book or don't know to buy the book. They need to hear the story out loud. And to me, it's very important that they hear the story, that they take it in their heart, that they think about it later, and it helps them to heal.
Well, Sandra Cisneros, can you read a little bit from Have You Seen Marie?
Yes, I would like to. The sun was already behind the freeway. Grackles gathering in the trees called out, "Marie? Marie? Marie?" I asked the river, "Have you seen Marie?" River said, "Mamita, you name it, I've seen it." "Do you mean you've seen her?" "I've seen everything, corazón de melón. Everything, 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 everything," River continued. "But I don't understand what you mean." There was something in my throat. I felt like I'd swallowed a spoon. I put my face under the water and cried. River said, "Don't you cry, mamas. I will take your tears and carry them to the Texas coast, where they'll mix with the salty tears of the Gulf of Mexico, where they will swirl with the waters of the Caribbean, with the wide sea called Sargasso, the water roads of the Atlantic, with the whirls and eddies around the Cape of Good Hope, around that hat called Patagonia, the blue waters of the Black Sea, and the pearl-filled waters around the islands of Japan, the coral currents of Java, the rivers of the several continents, the Aegean of Homer's legend, the mighty Amazon, and the wise Nile, the grandmother and grandfather rivers Tigris and Euphrates, the great mother river, the sandy Yangtze, the dancing Danube, and through the Strait of the Dardanelles, along the muddy Mekong and the sleepy Ganges, waters warm as soup and waters cold to the teeth, waters carrying away whole villages, waters washing away the dead, and waters bringing new life, the salty and the sweet, mixing with everything, 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 everything."
Sandra Cisneros, one of the issues that keeps coming up is immigration. But from what I understand, the flow has turned into primarily a trickle, and yet political parties are making hay out of this thing and deporting people for DUIs.
You know, when we had the last election, I don't know if you noticed, but no one wanted to talk about immigration. They did not want to talk about it. And that, to me, was a red flag, that neither party wanted to talk about it. I don't think either party has dealt with it well at all. And so now it's gotten to the point that it has. I think post 9/11, we've seen such a disastrous policies on the border. I live 2.5 hours away from the border, and I've seen a lot of changes for the communities there. And it's a very sad situation. I feel like it's an occupied zone, you know, and we're losing a lot of our rights. Both sides of the border are terrified. We're united in being fearful. Both the Mexican population and the U.S. population is united in fear. So you would think that with these two communities united in fear, that we would ask each other, what can we do to make you feel more secure? That would be the question we should be asking. All of the country should be asking that in this time of global interrelations, don't you think? How can we make you feel more secure? Because we're all afraid. We're living in an age of fear.
But I think, you know, it's easier to for them to want to build on the fear rather than ease
it. Yes, that's right. But we have extraordinary human resources we have not tapped. And I wish we would invest the time and money, energy, and creativity that we invest in violence, Pentagon, for example, into peacemakers. We have those resources on the planet. We have people who resolve things peacefully living among us. We don't just have to think about people that have passed away. We have those leaders alongside us now. Why don't we create a peace Pentagon where thinkers think of alternatives to war and violence? And I know that sounds crazy, but that's the only way you're going to arrive at creative solutions, by thinking outside the box.
And maybe thinking outside the political parties themselves.
I do think so. I do think so, yes.
How does the Mexican drug wars, do they affect San Antonio at all?
Yes, I think that it's very sad to see how the businesses on both sides are suffering from the drug wars. Communities, that border was always porous. You know, people have been going and coming back since before the Spaniards arrived. And now we see communities that have family members on the other side, very frightened. People are not traveling south, and people south can't come north. So I just feel saddened for families, for example, that are divided by that violence. I think Mexico is suffering so much. There are parts of Mexico that seem safer than ever, Mexico City, some other towns further south, but that whole border area is under siege. And I think that violence has affected us in the form of the consumption of drugs. The sale of arms creates the violence over there, and our consumption of drugs creates the crazy state that we're living in, where violence can erupt at any moment.
So what can we do about it? I mean, my thought is the proliferation of guns, for one thing, should be stopped.
Yes.
But, you know, we're in a country that no one, because of fear of the NRA, is willing to say, hey, you know, it's not Second Amendment. You know, these are killing machines.
That's right. I think it's a relationship that needs to be resolved, because it's so interconnected. It needs to be resolved with both countries, and with both countries desiring to create peace.
And that would also include finally dealing with the drug laws.
I feel very sad about it, because, you know, we who live close to the border, we see how it affects the families close up. We know about that violence. And in many people who are not involved with drugs, who are just everyday people, are affected and victimized by that violence. You know, you only have to go to Juarez to witness how those murders are still going on, how that violence is still going on.
Well, when you're looking at our political situation and the future, do you offer people advice?
Richard, I felt when I turned 40 that with all the attention, with the microphones put in front of me, with the media listening, that I had a responsibility to be wiser than my years. So I made an intention at 40 to become smarter and wiser. So I don't have all the answers. I wish I was the Dalai Lama. So what I've tried to do is put the intention to become smarter and wiser. I have to be the ambassador of everything, of issues I'm not that well informed on. And I'm learning a lot by reading teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh, Pema Chodron. They teach me, because I feel I have a responsibility to the communities that I speak to.
Well, here's a question that's, I don't know if there's any way to answer it. I have a lot of Jewish Buddhist friends, but you grew up, I guess, in a Catholic environment.
I did.
How do you think your Catholicism and your Buddhism match up?
Well, you know, the Catholicism believes in the Virgen de Guadalupe, the Mother of God, is worshipped, especially in Latin America. But I find her very empowering. I find that the Virgen de Guadalupe allowed me to come back to parts of my upbringing that I had disregarded, that I'd walked away from. My family is from the neighborhood, the very district where the Virgin of Guadalupe appeared. That's where I have roots, and that neighborhood in Mexico City. So she's a personal icon, not just a cultural icon to me. I used to play on the little hill where she appeared. So I feel that I was raised somewhat of a Catholic, but with very liberal parents. And I've had to find my spirituality. I've been looking for it since I was a child. And I would find it in pieces of art and in music and in flowers and trees. And now I've made full circle and come back to finding God in clouds and flowers and trees. And to me, the Virgen de Guadalupe is just a vessel for me to recognize my own God within myself. I don't feel that she's God. She's a mirror for me to find God in myself.
Sandra Cisneros, before we went on the air, you were talking about the various works you have coming up. So let's be a little bit more specific. You have a collection of essays that's going to be coming out?
Yes, I have a collection of essays that have been gathered up from all their disparate homes. Some are new, some are old, and putting them all together under one roof. And I have a new collection of poetry I'm very excited about. I'm still finishing that. And I have some short fiction that I'm just starting and some autobiographical vignettes that I'm starting. And I always get many ideas. I have a spoken lecture called Writing in My Pajamas that I need to record on paper to share with people that need a jump start for the writing or people who are afraid of writing. And I've recently been doing a spoken lecture called How to Become a Chingona in 12 Easy Lessons.
A what?
A chingona. You don't know what a chingona is? Well, it's one of those words that, would have to be beeped out if I translated it. But it's a very powerful expletive in Spanish. It's usually used with some guy. And I wanted to think of a word that would make women feel really powerful. So How to Become a Chingona in 12 Easy Lessons is a lecture actually on spirituality, on how to come into your own power.
You've been listening to an interview with Sandra Cisneros, whose latest book is Have You Seen Marie, illustrated by Esther Hernandez. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.